Welcome to today's Boost podcast with me, Graham Farmer. And today I welcome one half of Juice and Charger, the drum and bass act, Pete Bott. Pete, following his career as a successful artist, writer and producer, started his legal career and qualified as a solicitor in 2012. His clientele include echolocation booking agency, which includes people like Major Lazer, Marshmello, Chasing Status, Tile Yard Music, which includes like Cigar, like Ella Eyre, Joel Corry. So he's got some big clients. We talked a lot about live streaming. We talk about a lot about how clients have been handling the situation. We talked about obviously gigs as well, and how he's been handling for his clients, and when they're looking at gigs for this year. So this is a really good podcast. I really enjoyed this conversation. Let's jump into it. Hey Pete, how are you? Thanks for joining me. And if you can just give us a little background about yourself.
Hello Graham.
Hello mate.
Hello, how are you doing?
Not bad, how are you?
All right, thank you, yeah. I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I like to see you're on brand in the house.
Yes, yes. Well, this is kind of like the YouTube studio as well. So sort of everything kind of, yeah, the camera's there. So. Yeah, it kind of fits in now. I used to have the window like behind me, and it's now we moved the desks around. It actually makes it a much better studio. It's really cool.
Yes, you'll know about what we do musically through Shelley.
Yes.
So that's the bulk of what we do. But my day job is to work in music law. So
cool.
I work for a firm called Sound Advice, which is in Tile Yard Studios in King's Cross.
Yeah, of course.
I worked there, and so Jules, I think you know Jules, as in Judge Jules, I think you know him, right?
Yes, I've known him for a long time, yeah.
Yeah, so we worked together. I work primarily advising artists, also advising independent record labels, and artists, kind of all genres, but a lot of drum and bass stuff. So people like Sigma and Hybrid Minds. I work with one of my colleagues on Pendulum, and then the firm advises people like Sub Focus and Dimension, Chasing Status. So there's just like tons and tons of drum and bass clients.
I guess you do the drum and bass side, and Jules does more the house and the techno and the people that he knows side, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, my background before getting into drum and bass was more in rock. So, my probably best known client is a band called Bring Me the Horizon, who are. I don't know if they come across your radar at all.
They have come across my radar. I couldn't tell you what they play, but I have definitely know that name. And probably because it's been on Radio 1 while I've been in the car or something. That's probably where from.
Yeah. I mean, they're a five-piece band initially based in Sheffield. Well, they're still, most of them live in Sheffield.
Yeah.
But... yeah, I mean, they got a Brit nomination this year, and they got Grammy nominations and all that kind of stuff. So they're quite well known, but they're quite sort of to the heavy end of rock. Although it's kind of evolved, it was quite a metal kind of rock act to start with, but they've kind of branched out and they're kind of quite experimental now. So they do all sorts of stuff. But quite a lot of my clients are in that kind of world as well.
And what sort of, I guess, what are you like? What do you cut like advising wise? What do you cover? Is it releases and deals and?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that sort of, I guess like a modern music lawyer is, I guess, always been the case, but you're very much part of that artist's team. So you work very closely with management, and it can be advising on, record deals, publishing deals, can be distribution. That's a kind of the core of it, I suppose.
Yeah.
But that takes on a bit of a strategic role as well. So you're kind of thinking about which kind of labels and publishers to work with. Is it better to go the independent route and work with a distributor? Is it better to work with a label? In the types of deals that you're doing, you're looking short-term, long-term, singles or albums, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then it branches out, So since the whole coronavirus thing, I advise a booking agency called Echolocation.
Yep.
Sort of books, a whole bunch of people like Major Lazer and so a lot of big acts. And the questions have been about all the cancellations, where do the various parties stand under the contracts now that things have been cancelled because of coronavirus?
That of course, because I guess each side will be, I guess there's a contract in place and how that contract stands, and then who's, if the, I guess, deposits should be returned, I guess, part of it, and that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. So the big issue is that it really centers around insurance. So a lot of shows that were, if you took out insurance before, I think it was like the 23rd of January or something around about that kind of date, then it's possible that you, if you took appropriate cover, that you could be insured against coronavirus.
Right, cool.
If you took out insurance after that date, then I understand that you can't be properly insured because it was a known... The point about cancellation under what's called force majeure, which is basically unforeseen events, is they have to be unforeseen. And
yes.
by late January, people knew about it. So if you were booking a show in January, then it's not an unforeseen circumstance that it would have to be cancelled because of coronavirus. So the big problem is that a lot of things have been cancelled. Promoters don't have insurance in place. They've paid deposits, but they have to, pay a refund ticket. So either, they have to sort of cash flow that, or they go bust, or they have to ask for the deposits back. Artists have incurred costs, flights, accommodation, crew, whatever else.
Yep.
So it's just really unfortunate. I mean, the money has been lost. These events have been cancelled, but then it's just a question of who, where the liability lies and who's going to pay for it.
Sounds like a big headache.
Yeah, I mean, I think thankfully people are being, for the most part, fairly reasonable about it. And that kind of, that saying, we're all in this together, it does kind of hold true for the most part in the live music scene right now, because it's pretty short-sighted. If people cancel and then as artists they retain deposits or they insist on their full fee being paid, whatever, all these promoters are going to go bust and then they're going to have nowhere to play next year. So
yes.
It's a bit of people having to sort of play a bit more of a long-term, take a long-term view on it. So my advice to sort of agents, and I don't really have any, I've got one promoter client, but generally it's agents and artists. Mm. And it's generally saying, look, if you need to retain some of the deposit to cover for costs that you've actually already incurred and you can't recover yourself, maybe that's fair enough. But everything else, you should consider paying back to promoters, because, we're all fucked, frankly. So,
yeah.
And if you want, hopefully this stuff will lift. We're hoping, the various different dates thrown about for when live stuff might come back on stream, but I'd hope by at least early next year there'll be small club shows and stuff that'll start. And if everyone's, we want people still to be in the game, clubs still to happen. So yeah.
That's interesting. You're saying early next year. I kind of felt the same as well.
Yeah, I think so. Like I said, I mean, I've spoken to quite a lot of people in the industry about this, and the feeling is, there's sort of some optimistic penciling in of dates for Q4, and maybe sort of small cap shows will happen. But realistically, I don't see any festivals happening till next summer at the earliest. And I think anything over 1,000 cap, I don't know, you're looking at maybe March, April next year, I think, before those things start to come back.
Yeah.
But, who knows, really?
Exactly.
Earlier. I think the unfortunate thing that some people have chosen to do is to book shows for, say, this kind of time of year. They were cancelled initially, then they've tried to rearrange them for sort of September, October, and then possibly have to cancel them again. And I think that was, it was very optimistic when they were rebooked for that time. And I think people start to get fed up, fans, whatever, if things keep getting shifted around. And it's hard to, you basically keep losing money because you're booking things around it and then having to cancel them again and again. So
yeah,
I think most people now are erring on the side of caution and saying, look, we'll probably just park this until next year. If something comes along earlier, great, we'll do it. But yeah, not counting on it.
I think a lot of fans have kind of kept tickets and kind of kept that the event will happen, and essentially they've spent that money, so it's kind of gone, and might as well keep the ticket, which is really nice to see as well,
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what you'd encourage as well from fans, is that, it keeps the promoters in business if they're not having to return that money. If they're saying, look, this, the show is going to happen, it might not happen for 6 to 9 months, but it will happen, and you're going to have your ticket will be valid at that point. So,
yeah,
kind of try and help everybody out by just holding on to that ticket and leaving the money with the promoter.
Yeah, exactly. And then I guess other big questions around that have been, are you doing anything with live streams? Have you had to deal with any Anything around those?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, really interesting area of all of this because, you know, typically if you were doing, if you're in an, it only really becomes a legal issue for the most part when you're in an exclusive deal. So if you're, as an artist, you've signed to a label, excuse me, and they've got, you know, exclusive rights to your audio and usually audio visual recording services, they kind of control what you can do. And the reason that they acquire those rights is generally in respect of, you know, recordings obviously, but also music videos and that kind of thing. So when, you know, whenever someone is doing a live show these days and the promoter will come along quite often at the 11th hour and say, by the way, we want to stream tonight's show and broadcast it on our YouTube channel or whatever else, you usually have to run that agreement by the label, and they, most times they'll sign off on it because most of the time it is a live stream, and any kind of rebroadcast of that or, you know, on demand kind of reviewing of that is fairly limited. But when an artist then tries to monetize that themselves and, for example, do pay-per-view shows or, you know, set things up like gigs that are kind of ticketed, but obviously there's no, you know, they might book out a venue and use that. So I think the sort of indie folk artist Laura Marling is doing some stuff in Union Chapel where there's, you know, a show booked and the tickets have been sold, like, you know, just like anything else, but then it's sort of geo-locked, so only people from certain territories can kind of view that show.
Wow, that's cool.
So then, you know, so say it's all kind of like touring from one place. So she's doing
that's cool.
I think she's doing a couple of shows. So the first show is just you a lot to the US, the second one perhaps to, you know, to the UK, and in the same venue, but doing different sets, you know, rather than just rebroadcasting the same thing. But when you're monetizing that, suddenly I think labels are going to say, well, hang on, that's an audiovisual recording. We own that. We have the rights to that. And so you then have this issue where the artists would be hoping that that money comes to them to make up for the shortfall in live earnings. Mm-hmm. But the labels are starting to say, well, we have your rights in audiovisual recordings, so actually that money should come to our, you know, we have the rights to control it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of, it's just one of these things that people are talking about. And I'm hoping that common sense will prevail and labels won't be too greedy. Artists will also try and involve labels as part of that kind of process. But that only that's kind of a, for artists that have got exclusive deals.
Yeah.
If it's not exclusive deals, then, you know, it's, there's still some interesting legal issues, but it's more then I think about moving beyond the novelty of seeing your favorite DJ in their kind of kitchen, you know, playing a set, which is pretty cool.
Mm.
But I sort of think that's going to wear a bit thin after, I don't know, a month or so. And then then at what point you start doing more interesting stuff. So like, Coven, for example, I don't know if have you seen their Another Home thing?
Yeah, I think so.
So they've kind of created a virtual club, and I don't know if they've launched it yet, but it's kind of, it's a live stream, but there's kind of more to it than just, you know, Katie in her, like her bedroom or kitchen or something playing a set. So there's quite a lot of interesting questions around it, for sure.
Yeah, I saw the Festival Junction 2 are doing a VR festival on the same day that Junction 2 would have happened.
Oh,
which is quite cool. And I guess do you see more of these bigger artists then charging for live streams and doing more playing their own music, I guess, because I think that's where Laura Marling might be, because she's obviously playing all her own music and it's an actual live performance, whereas a live DJ performance, yes, you pay for it in a club, but would you pay for it as a stream, because you can just watch anybody at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. Like, I was speaking to a manager a couple of weeks back about this, and he's not encouraging his artists to do these live streams because, you know, part of, as we all know, the part of the kind of the DJ experience is being in the club and the atmosphere and everything else. And I think that so much of that is stripped away. And once the novelty's gone of seeing someone in their own place do a set, I'm not sure how interesting it is. And a lot of people I've spoken to say, oh, I saw someone was doing a stream. Yeah, I tuned in to watch, you know, couple of minutes of it, then I moved on, or I had it on in the background, I wasn't really paying attention. So I mean, I don't know, I think there's room to innovate, and I think you could do some very cool things depending on, you know, what you've got in your home, or
yeah,
you know, you set stuff up, you know, what you can order off Amazon, I guess, you know.
Yes.
Create something cool.
I've seen some really good ones though, we've tuned into one every Friday because the music's been different. The artist in question has been choosing different genres and choosing different music policies. Mm-hmm. But also, he fully interacts with the crowd, and you fully get involved. It's like, you know, it's been a good 2 hours, and we've watched the whole 2 hours. You know, because it has been the right time on a Friday once you've had a few beers I was at a kitchen table, so it's the music's on and you know, a couple of wines, and that's been good fun, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely. I think there's a place for it, and there's been some cool sets. Mm. I think that it's in a way it sounds weird, but I think it's quite an exciting opportunity for people to try and do more interesting things in this space. So I think that in sort of 3 to 6 months, you're going to see people do more than what they're doing right now, and I think the interaction part is key. So I mean, as Juice in Charge, we've done a few sets on Rough Tempo, and they've got that thing with, you know, like an iPad in the booth, and mm-hmm. it's a Facebook live stream, so people are commenting and you can reply while you're playing and all the rest of it. And I've seen a few streams where they've got the comments, you know, scrolling by the side of the of the performance. And so I think when people start to maybe engage a little bit more and make it more of a two-way thing, or, you know, that kind of stuff will be really cool. But, you know, it depends. And again, that's sort of pushing some DJs a little bit out of their comfort zone, because a lot are used to just, you know, heads down.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And leave the MC or whoever else to do that kind of interaction. So to suddenly be kind of playing and also trying to respond to comments live, and, you know, that's cool. You know, I hope that people will do more of that, because that's what makes it more engaging.
Yeah, you get to know more about the artist, I guess, and it makes you get more interaction with the artist and learn more about the artist as they respond, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
I guess it must be easier as well from a drum and bass point of view, where obviously you do have an MC who could be on the comments and chatting to the audience whilst you're doing the DJing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's things that you could do, and I think that, you know, having some kind of simultaneous sort of split screen stuff with someone, people in different locations, you know, I think people need to take some more chances and see where we get to with it. But yeah, it's interesting. We've been asked to do a few, and we live in North London, but we came up to Scotland just before the lockdown, because we've got quite a small place in London. I think it had got cabin fever very quickly. So we came up here, and we just don't have all the equipment that we would need to do it. So it would be very much trying to like DJ on a laptop or something. I don't think it'd be much to watch, and it wouldn't be good, but yeah, I mean, I think open-minded to trying that kind of stuff, and certainly if we had the equipment, we'd be more than up for doing it.
Yeah, I've seen some good ones where people are doing, like, where artists are doing, like, production. I saw one, there was a house music artist yesterday called Endor. He basically made a track in 10 minutes live whilst he was, like, live streaming. And I thought that was firstly, very brave, but secondly, really, like, that would have been so interactive to watch and interesting for producers to watch, I guess, as well.
Oh, definitely, and I think that's been really nice. There is genuinely a sense of community, isn't there? And it's all about, you know, trying to, I guess, take people into your own world. I guess if you're an artist, if you can't play live, there's other ways that you can interact with people, but doing it in kind of a very genuine way. So if you're like, well, you know, when we've got our monthly podcast, for example, you know, and it's just kind of a way of bringing people into our world, talking about what we're doing. It's not all just introing songs, where we talk about the stuff that we're doing. And I think the same with tutorials. Be like, well, you know, I'm stuck in, I'm going to make this track, why not just switch on a camera and put a live stream on, and people are interested in watching. It's cool, they can see what I get up to. And I think that is, it's quite inspiring, because I think for a lot of like young producers, you know, you hear that very high end stuff and you think, it almost like seems like it's been beamed down from space, like it just sounds good. Like, how do I even do that? And when you can see someone sort of break it down and do it on a video, which is quite interactive, I mean, I'm all for it. Yeah, for sure.
Have you seen any brand deals around live streams yet? Like, I get the feeling that, like, some of these big artists, if they were doing regular and doing a regular, like turning up at the same time every week, and the stream numbers were getting bigger and bigger, or the stream combination of streams over like a 10-week period, mm-hmm. that you would then see a brand going, well, there's a product placement place to be put there, and there's a deal to be done there, and you know, that would then monetize the stream for the artist, you know?
No, absolutely. I think, again, speaking to another manager, I think it might be Sigma's manager or something, about this recently, saying, you know, I think the first probably 2-3 months of all of this has been understandably seeing a massive upheaval, concern, anxiety, and not that that's completely gone by any means, but people are starting to adjust to life like this now. And I think originally sort of streams were seen as being kind of, you know, for charity or just for fun and just to try and give people a bit of, you know, hope and optimism, which is obviously, you know, commendable. But I think now the kind of economic reality is hitting in and people are going, you know what, actually we can't carry on doing this for free. This is our livelihood. And you know, while others might be able to work from home and, you know, DJs, other bands, live performers can't do that. So I think you definitely will see more of that. I'm aware of some deals being talked about now. So I think before the end of the year, you're going to start to see more kind of branded content, you know, whether that's some kind of, I don't know, online residence, you know, residency or something like that, branded by someone.
I mean, I think that'd be amazing. It's like the first online residency. Would that be quite a that'd be quite a cool thing? Like if you were the first person to have the same place every week, that'd be quite cool.
Yeah, definitely. And again, yeah, there's room to do kind of extra things. I think that you can bring brands in. It's not always a kind of. I think quite often fans, if you like, will see brand deals as potentially being, you know, artists cashing in. But if done right, I think actually brands don't want to necessarily shove their products down people's faces. They want to down people's throats. Sorry, I think they want to make cool stuff happen. So yes. I think you'll see what brands will be able to do is to provide some budget, A, to pay the artist, but B, to actually get some cool kit to them or whatever else that we're not. I mean, the kind of home recorded stuff is quite cool to a point, but it'd be interesting to see some more unusual bits of tech.
Yeah, and a brand would definitely provide, like they would definitely level up the tech and they'd definitely, you know, and it could be as subtle as the artist wearing the clothing and it kind of branded at the start, you know, and that's, I guess that's enough for a fan and just to make it look for something cool, you know. And I guess as well, also as things, like as the lockdown reduces and people can actually go to places, I guess there will be clubs that will be able to have people in them, not artists in them, to do streams from the venues, and which would then add a different level to it as well. Like, for instance, the defective one with Ministry of Sound before the kind of lockdown happened.
Yeah, well, definitely. I think there's going to be more of that, and we're seeing that as being actually it's something that's taken in some respects from the sort of the opera or ballet space or the theatre space where, you know, there's certain theatre productions which are broadcast live into cinemas. So if you can't afford to go to the West End or you live, you know, too far from London, for example, there are certain cinemas that will then live stream theatre productions or operas or ballets. And I think that's again probably something that's going to come out of all of this, is that even when there's a return to live events, you're going to find that the certain clubs will have got the tech and the enthusiasm to try and do something as a live stream offering as well. And it's a little bit more difficult, a bit more challenging, I think, in dance music, because you know, if you're talking about Laura Marling, you can kind of sit down with a few people and, like, say have a glass of wine and sit and watch a live acoustic performance, and that kind of works in that space. I'm not that sure how, once we're out of lockdown, whether, you know, are people going to want to invite a few friends around to their flat and stream a DJ from a club? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I think people will, but like I think there'll be, I think there's definitely a balance of people. There'll be a balance of people that want to go out. They'll want to be part of that low cap and people to just be in the club. And there'll be other people that will go, you know, no, I'm not going there until there's an antidote. And no, I'm not going to go there in case I get it. And, you know, know that clubs are sweaty places and viruses breed in sweaty places. And especially when there's low immune systems from whatever else you're putting in your body, you know?
I
think there's going to be a definite balance for a while where there will be, you'll have some mates around and it'll be, let's watch that artist on the telly because it's safer, for instance, you know, for straight away, you know?
No, I say that. It's a very good point. I guess, obviously people do tend to, you know, get mates around before going out and get some music on, get the first drinks in and all the rest of it. So there's no reason why that wouldn't just extend. And it's just kind of like a house, it's going to be just like house parties, isn't it, right?
So it will be, yeah, it will be. And obviously it's cheaper at the bar and, yeah, exactly. what I have just thought it could be an interesting time for the DJ tech. Because obviously where the standard before has been Pioneer, because that's what's in the club, Mm-hmm. Like, this could be that time for Denon, for instance, who are rolling out this new kit to be, you know, sponsoring loads of cool streams and mm-hmm. and therefore getting their kit to big artists and big people, because they're putting some money behind it and converting people, so that when we do go back to the clubs, there is a definite switch of, it's not all Pioneer, it's something else, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like you say, that what I sort of said earlier, you know, we can't do live streams right now because we don't have all the kit here that we would need. But depending on how long this goes, we might kind of change our views. But I have seen some people who would normally just use the Pioneers in the club, they are kind of cobbling stuff together with a little controller and a laptop and whatever else. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Shelley will have told you, but, you know, from our background, we come in as sort of live musicians and from band background. And so I've always looked at, like, DJing as being, you know, as a means of giving up musical performance. Mm-hmm. And so long as what's coming out of the speakers sounds great, I don't really care how we go about doing it. You know, there's still kind of selection of tunes, there's still kind of knowing how to program a set with dynamics and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think that might be quite refreshing, feeling like there's less snobbery. You know, people can bring what, you know, use whatever kit works for them and do some pretty cool and interesting things that you're not necessarily able to do on you know, your CDJs in a club or whatever. If you've got people using laptops and other bits they've cobbled together, they might do some more interesting things. So
yes, yeah, I think totally.
Yeah,
I guess from an artist point of view, like, a lot of our audience is new artists. I guess, like, they wouldn't need music lawyers for the most points. Is there kind of advice you'd give to new artists around kind of positioning themselves right?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? So, you know, my kind of, like, background, let's say, is in band background. So Becky and I were in a band. We were signed to Fox about 12 years ago. And I remember at that time, the label said to us, you need to speak to a music lawyer. And I remember thinking, what? Why do I need a lawyer? You know, it's just so kind of alien. And then now, having done this for like 8 years, it seems odd in a way that people don't think about it sooner. And I guess my advice to artists would be, like, you know, first of all, you love your music and that's the passion that's driven you. And there's no kind of taking away from that. And I'm not, that should remain the kind of primary focus. But for most that want to have a career in it, it is then their business and they are, you know, owner managers of their own business. So they need to learn to put the music to one side and then figure out how their business should be run effectively. And most businesses have accountants, most businesses have lawyers, most businesses have other sort of professional advisors on their, you know, on their team, as it were, to kind of help them out. So I think for new artists, I think it is worth engaging with the industry. You don't necessarily need to engage a lawyer immediately, but, you know, I work with so many new artists and it's just a case of, you know, we have the conversations, they see that, you know, I'm not suited in a suit and tie or two heads or whatever. People have also, I mean, to be honest, this is why I'm quite wary about talking too much about my day job with what I do, because music, you know, I've been a musician since I was like 12 years old and that's my passion. It just so happens that when the band split up, I had a career change and I did something else and I've fallen into doing this job, which is, you know, it's amazing. I get to work with some of my favorite artists. But what it's shown me is that the value in having professionals, that, you know, it's the same with you. You know, you provide with your podcasts and all your tutorials and all the rest of the stuff. It's coaching. It's telling people how the industry works. It is a business. And, you know, so you need people that can advise you properly. But I think before even getting there, it's worth artists just being aware of the basic rights, you know, understanding the difference between song copyright and recording copyright, you know.
Yes.
The collecting societies. Excuse me, what the collecting societies do, it's understanding some kind of basic deal terms, I suppose. So if you're, for example, going to a distributor, you know what sort of royalty or what sort of commission you should be paying a distributor. Or if a label comes to you and offers you a deal, you know what kinds of royalties you should be expecting and how they should be calculated and stuff.
So, yeah, and I guess terms within those contracts as well, like how long the always the question is me is, should I be signing it for that long and should I be signing it for that amount and is that percentage normal? And so I guess that, yes, that's a great tip. Yeah, like learning those things and learning those, what each one means, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I did quite a lot of lecturing for various different universities, and I do some stuff for Help Musicians UK, sort of like funded, you know, hour of time with various musicians. And a lot of the time it's kind of just, I guess, explaining how the industry works, you know, the kind of key sort of areas of the industry, if you like, and then how rights flow through those different areas of the industry and how you monetize them. So the artists understand when they're creating music, the rights that exist within that music, and not just within the music, but, you know, there are, like you talked about branding earlier, you know, the artist brand, how you can monetize all those different things so that as a business, you can become, you know, you're self-employed, it's your own business, how you can actually achieve the maximum amount of revenue by understanding the rights that you are and the sort of potential revenue streams for that business. And then kind of, you know, you can go a bit down the rabbit hole then and start to try and understand how, you know, how everything works. But there are some good books, you know, I think there's the kind of classic book of the Ann Harrison Music, the Business book, which is a really good place to start. It's a very entry level, but useful guide for musicians to understand the typical deals and the deal terms and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, also books wise, there's the Swedish House Mafia's former manager. She's just released a free book on obschool.com, and it's got management and breaks down deals. She literally just at the beginning of lockdown she wrote it and then has given it away on the website.
Yeah, that's cool. My firm just put an article up. I think it's going up on the Help Musicians.
Oh, amazing. We can link to that in the show notes, in the cards, or wherever this goes on YouTube. Or we can. So if you send me the link, I'll put it in the information below.
Right. Okay. Cool. I'm not sure when it's going to go online, but certainly once that's online, you know, that's kind of things that people can be doing at this time. You know, there is an opportunity to do some of the boring stuff you never really wanted to do. You know, you kind of looking into your registrations with collecting societies, looking through various different deals and seeing where any money that should be payable to you, you know, have you received it, is also a chance to actually try and understand the industry better. Because, I mean, I tell you that from seeing artists of, like I said, all kind of levels, when you see the artists that are successful, it's not just the music that's great. It's that someone, whether that's the artist, that's the manager, or whoever else, someone, and it's ultimately got to start with the artist, but someone within that team will have a very good understanding of the industry, how they can navigate the industry without, you know, getting ripped off or entering into bad deals, but also how to work with the right people at the right time. And that's, you know, so if you're making great tunes, I suppose it's one of these things where, rather than having three great tunes, make two great tunes, then spend the other time researching the industry. So those two great tunes have got more chance of reaching the right audience than they might otherwise, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking this literally that point earlier, that there's a few artists that I know that are making some amazing music, but they just seem to be awful at the admin side. And that's what's holding them back. And they're kind of just either they're just laziness of it, or they're just not knowledge of it. It's just that's what's really not helping them push forward. On your point about the royalties thing as well, like I know a couple of artists literally at the start of this lockdown, they went, we're not going to do any live streams, we're not doing any of that, all we're going to sit and do for the next 12 through however long it takes is sort out the labels publishing, my artist publishing, and then start claiming all my back royalties, because I've got nothing's in place for that. And I know there must be a big pot of cash somewhere waiting for me, because I've had all these tracks on Radio One, I've had all these tracks on, you know, played across multiple places, and it must be just by doing that, that's going to help my firstly my situation at home, and, you know, future proof for me a little bit more as well, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the thing, is that I don't know if it's particularly a British thing or as an artist thing, but there seems to be kind of like talking about money is almost like a dirty word. But
yeah,
it can't be just a hobby or whatever forever. You know, if it's something you want to make into a career, it has to pay the bills. And if you're making music and it's earning money, then you got to find where that money is. And so, I mean, you know, as I said, my job as a lawyer is to kind of help with the artist and management or whoever else, just try and put the right kind of deals in place. But also it's a kind of, can be almost like a bit of an educational role. It's taking clients, talking them through agreements and saying, right, you know, this is how this type of agreement works. These are the dates you need to put in your diary for accounting, for example. this is what you should be entitled to, you know, this is what you need to invoice for. But it was amazing. It was always stuck with me. I did this one deal for a kind of like a grime rapper, and he was a young kid, you know, and his mum was in on the kind of conversation, and I was trying to explain this contract, and I'm like, you know, I get it, right? You know, law is not the most exciting thing. I've kind of made my peace with that, but it's important. And I'm trying to explain this contract, and he's just literally on his phone, you know, scrolling through, not paying. And I'm like, I'm stopping him, going, look, I know this is boring, but you got to pay attention. And she just said, oh, don't mind him. He just wants the money so he can buy trainers. I was like, yeah. Well, yeah, okay, fair enough. You know, I get that, but I on a more serious note, I think the amount of talented people that fall out of the industry because they can't make it work, because they can't make the business work, they can't go on. You know, it's all very well if you're living with parents, or I don't know, you're a student, you've got a student loan or whatever else to support you. But once, I guess, you know, real life kicks in, if you don't understand how the business works and you've signed terrible deals, it's not going to be long before the wheels fall off.
Yeah,
exactly. It's really sad to see people, you know, could have had a really great career fall by the wayside just because they didn't take the time to try and understand the business, you know, so.
Cool. Thank you, my friend. Thanks for joining me. This has been super interesting. I've really enjoyed talking to you. It's been really fun.
Thank you very much.
I've learned a lot.
Good. Glad to hear. So yeah, as I said, my firm's called Sound Advice, based cool. in London, and if people want to get in touch, then they can give me a call, give me an email.
Cool. I will link all your contacts and stuff below in the show notes, and if you go on YouTube, it'll be in the content below. And yeah, thanks for joining me, man.
Yeah, very welcome. All right, cool.
Thanks again for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have, please go, if you're listening to an Apple podcast, please go and give it a rating, give it a thumbs up, share it. It really helps the podcast grow on Apple Podcasts and goes up the chart, which means we can get bigger guests with bigger numbers, and which gives you more information and more tips. Thanks so much again for joining us. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll see you next time. I've been Graham Farmer. Bye.